ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
One of Australia's most recognisable broadcasters is facing the biggest battle of his life. Alan Jones has pleaded not guilty to multiple historical sexual assault charges, and now the case is before the courts.
I'm not going to dwell here on the allegations made about me, other than to say that I refute them entirely.
As witnesses step into the box and the evidence unfolds, the Case of podcast will be your eyes and ears inside the courtroom. Search the Case of podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been dubbed the Day of Deals by the Albanese government, with agreements on gambling reforms, the NDIS overhaul, the widow's tax fix, and the news bargaining incentive, all done and dusted on Wednesday. And amid the flurry of legislation, there are also concerns about actually implementing it. It's one thing legislating, but getting it done. And a debate on the tobacco tax is continuing, with the Health Minister Mark Butler dismissing One Nation's suggestion of a cut of 75% of that excise as a cheap headline. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm David Spears.
And David, Parliament sat late last night to pass legislation. Labor and the Coalition have struck a series of deals on actually heaps, like so much deal-making. Like, and in fact, both sides of politics here, you know, just shows we a lot of agreement on big things.
Yep. And I think this is really interesting, right? Because, sure, the two sides can do deals from time to time on certain things. It happened under Peter Dutton. I'm trying to think if it happened under Susan Lee. Probably not a lot because she wasn't there for very long. But rarely, I'm trying to think ever, have we seen this many pieces of legislation bundled together in a deal, basically, after, what was it, three or four meetings between Angus Taylor and Anthony Albanese last week, ironing out some of the details this week, and bam, across, as you mentioned, NDIS, gambling, the news media bargaining code, and the widow's tax as well. So, I think it's significant for a few reasons. It's important for the Coalition to show that they aren't just a party of saying no. I mean, what did they used to call Peter Dutton? Captain No is what Labor called him. Andrew Hastie said this morning on radio that, you know, we can't just be a party that votes no. So he's kind of acknowledging that they want to show that they can be sensible. They can be a party of government, unlike One Nation. And we can come back to them. I think, you know, the Coalition showing it can compromise, make decisions in the national interest, whatever you think about the details here, and sure, plenty of criticism about where they've landed on NDIS and gambling and so on. But they want to show they're doing the right thing in the national interest. For Labor, I think this was the time to do it. Much later in the term, forget it. You're never going to get the two sides holding hands on anything as you get closer to the next election. So now was the time for Albanese to do this. And I think, you know, we've made this point a few times, PK. He's a bit of a master of the parliamentary arts. Mm-hmm. He's got these two pathways through the Senate, one with the Coalition, one with the Greens. And boy, doesn't he love that. He does deals with the Greens after the budget on negative gearing and capital gains tax. And he'll come back to the Greens on the trusts that he still needs to legislate later this year. But he uses the Coalition pathway on all the things that he's doing this week. So this week is Liberal or Coalition deal week. You know, in a few weeks from now, it'll be back to the Greens. But he's just able, he has this opportunity to pivot between the two, and he's using that to maximum effect. I just find it really interesting that there are reasons why both sides wanted to do this deal this week.
Yeah, and if you can think about it in terms of policy approach, you know, you use the Coalition road when you need to do sort of centre-right stuff. And yep, let's be honest, this government, I think, does a lot of centre-right stuff, more than people realise. And then when you need to do your sort of Labor-lefty stuff, and I'm being very, you know, crude about it, but I do think you go the Greens pathway.
Well, the environment laws at the end of last year, for example.
Exactly. Yep. And so he actually has quite a good and functional Senate pathways to get his SHIT done, yes?
And it's a lot easier than having a crossbench in the Senate that you've got to negotiate with three different independents on the crossbench, right? You're dealing with one block or the other block, the Coalition or the Greens. I do think that's easier than the what Labor faced in their first term.
A lot easier. And you're right, he's kind of the master of this. This is also the advantage, of course, of being in the parliament for so long. And he does have that mastered. I mean, it's his kind of his trick every time.
Yeah, and I think one little sort of example of that is sort of clearing the decks this week for this deal to be done with the Liberals. He didn't want to muddy it with other issues. I know immigration for the government is still, we're still waiting for Tony Burke to appear at the press club and announce all of that. And I'm not saying this is the reason why it was delayed, but one of the reasons why I don't think it came out this week is because he didn't want to muddy this week's deals with the coalition by bringing in the migration debate midway through the week. I think he's very deliberately kept the focus on these deals and getting them done.
Yeah, I think that is true. I mean, there are still some complications with the migration laws, and that's part of the reason as well.
And that'll be a fight. That'll be a big fight between the two sides. You know, as will various other things. We'll get to tobacco as well. There are lots of other fights to come, AI laws, all of that. And look, migration will be the big one. But trying to quarantine, you know, keep this week clearly focused on those issues that where they can cooperate.
So let's go to the specific deals. Gambling, of course. Claudia and I spoke about that yesterday. And we did see some coalition members, though, since we spoke. It actually happened across the floor. So Andrew Wallace and Nationals MP Pat Conaghan crossed the floor in the House of Reps. Liberal Senator Paul Scar crossing the floor in the Senate. It is significant. Andrew Wallace on RN Breakfast said something really, really powerful, I thought. I think the way these people have been speaking out has been, I think, consequential. I think it is interesting that they've chosen this issue to stand up on.
Yeah, look, I wouldn't say it's a huge breakout, but it's rare that you see, you know, major party MPs cross the floor. So it is significant. Obviously, in Labor, there are much higher consequences, i.e. getting booted out of the party if you don't stick to the caucus decision. So, yes, there are Labor MPs concerned at where they've landed, but they're sticking with the yes vote on this. I think where they've landed is an extremely complicated set of rules on gambling ads. I don't know about you, but, you know, try and get your head around how all of this works. But look, you know, unquestionably, there are some tighter curbs on gambling ads. There's no doubt about that. This is progress. But the ads will still be there. I think the stories of problem gamblers being preyed upon may still emerge as well. And I'm sure there will still be some pressure on both sides to go further on this. But that pressure won't be as intense without a bill before the parliament, a Senate inquiry underway, all of those things. So it won't be for another 3 years when these laws are now going to be reviewed that this will really come back onto the agenda, barring some other, you know, dramatic development. I think this will largely retreat as an issue or as a pressure point for the government for the next few years.
So then we have the NDIS overhaul.
Yep.
Such a big deal to so many people, and the deal's done. So let's get into some of the substantial amendments, 63 in total, passed the Senate at 8 o'clock last night. We're recording this on a Wednesday. It returns to the lower house, of course, for the final tick off. That's how it works, you know. It passes, goes back to the Senate, goes back to the lower house. It's a process. The opposition is supporting this after Labor quickly conceded to its attempted wedge that was, I said yesterday, I didn't think it was the biggest thing to stand up on. The
pass
widow's
your
tax.
Own bill or we won't support you on the widow's tax. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. But they got something and they said they've got something and maybe that's all it was about. But what are the changes? Is it significant?
Look, it's a lot of amendments, but I don't think it's all that substantial. Look, the coalition can claim a bit of a win on the fraud front. So there are amendments to banning kickbacks from providers to encourage people to use their services like cash or electronic devices or whatever. So that's banned. New offences, criminal and civil, to crack down on fraud. There are some new appeal rights for high needs participants if their funding is suddenly cut, and some new record keeping rules as well. But look, the fundamentals aren't changing here. You know, we're still going to see a change in eligibility for the NDIS, going from diagnosis to functional capacity. You're going to see basically hundreds of thousands potentially removed from the NDIS and hundreds of thousands more denied access to the NDIS as a result of that. You're going to see these big cuts in the community and social participation funding that participants get under their NDIS package. So all of this is going to change, setting up thriving kids. There's a hell of a lot of work still to do. And Mark Butler acknowledges this, whether it's the states agreeing to what, you know, he argues they've already agreed to but need to get cracking with, the thriving kids. But for those over the age of 8, so 9, 10-year-olds, teenagers and adults, what are they going to get if they're no longer on the NDIS? As he says, we've got a ton of work still to do on all of this, but the fundamentals are now done, agreed, passed through the parliament. I'm not surprised at all. I mean, the coalition raised some concerns along the way, but they were always going to back this. They tried in government to rein in the NDIS. Labor fought it. They had a different way of doing it. the rate at which it's growing is unsustainable. Both sides know that. I mean, Angus Taylor and the Coalition would have looked fiscally reckless if they'd not reached a deal, I think, on this week.
You can't bang on about something for years and then not do anything about it and maintain any credibility. So, you know, of course, it's not surprising that they went there.
It's difficult. And look, families are right to be anxious about all of this.
Well, how could you not be?
Yeah, absolutely.
How could you not be, especially with some things with bigger question marks than answers? And let's go to those. We talk about where the fights will be. I think the fight's the bigger fight right now. I mean, it's not at the federal level between the Coalition and Labor. It's between the Albanese government and the states. And that's in relation to what the states end up doing. Now, obviously, we know that Queensland hasn't even signed up to the Thriving Kids program, which is meant to be fully operational in January 2028. Other states are at different points, but they're all very critical, though.
Yeah, they are.
There's going to be a lot more fighting over this before it's resolved.
Yeah, and yes, there's some brinkmanship here and states wanting more from the Commonwealth for their hospitals and, you know, other services they'll have to stand up under Thriving Kids as well. That's all part of it, sure. Can't deny that. But at the end of the day, I think both of them are going to have to get cracking with this. It's due to start rolling out Thriving Kids in October, fully operational by 2028. It's not a lot of time in the scheme of NDIS reform and standing up something new like this. There's going to be a community expectation. And PK, what do you think? There's an LNP government in Queensland that haven't yet signed up. You've got the Coalition now here in Canberra at the federal level under Angus Taylor, agreeing to these changes, passing these changes into law, sitting down with the government to make this bipartisan. Surely that puts more pressure now on the Queensland LNP government to get moving on this. Can they hold out?
It should theoretically. But, you know, you're seeing at the moment fights between federal Labor and state Labor governments, particularly New South Wales. So there is... Federation is always tricky. You don't see, it's not, you know, we're the same colour, so it'll all be sorted out. I don't think it's quite like that. I think Queensland will fight the, you know, good fight for their own, in their own interests. I don't think that David Crisafulli cares so much about what Angus Taylor thinks or that whether the Liberals are on board at a national level. He cares if he has to pay more. And that's really where the fight's going to be. And, you know, there is a sort of... The NDIS was doing so much of the heavy lifting without any of the kind of states playing that role that it is a pretty dramatic shift to go back to more of a sharing, isn't it, David? Yeah. Like it's a big shift back in some ways.
So, I mean, again, Mark Butler argues they'd already agreed to this, the states. It's now a question of honour, right? That they've got this extra money they're already spending on hospitals as a result of this deal. They should stick to it. It's a matter of honour. I don't know if that's good. That's going to convince them to suddenly stump up. I think ultimately this will be something in National Cabinet at the leader level that will have to be settled again. And maybe that is going to require a bit more give and take from the Commonwealth or some, you know, clever accounting here to make both sides happy, because it needs to happen now. This legislation's passed. Thriving Kids needs to get cracking, because in the meantime, as we say, families are going to be very anxious. What is going to be there for those kids in particular who are no longer on the NDIS?
Mm. And at this stage, I think Mark Butler is definitely the right guy for the job. Everyone in Parliament talks about him as the sort of next Prime Minister. I don't think he's got enough name recognition at this stage, by the way, for that. Even though he's got a huge portfolio, there needs to be more work on that other side of the ledger. But he's very much one of the best ministers in the government. He's incredibly smart. Incredibly across his brief. So I think he's the right person to be doing the job, but that doesn't mean the job is, you know, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. I know they're saying there will be no delays, but I just, I'm not as convinced
about that. We've heard that before. Look, Mark Butler, I think this is a difficult reform to land. It's bedeviled both sides of politics for a while as the NDIS has grown at that, you know, the sort of astronomical rates it has. Landing this deal in the Parliament is a win for Mark Butler, no question. Delivering an outcome that doesn't end up in terrible stories of families being left high and dry and people with a disability being left high and dry. That's, I guess, what we'll have to wait and see as to how this plays out in practice, because, there are some pretty alarming concerns that came up through the Senate inquiry. from all sorts of experts and families about this. So let's see. But getting it to this point, yep, it's a win for Mark Butler. You're right. He's an impressive minister in the government. He's also a South Australian. If we're talking about who's going to be the next leader, that's another conversation. I don't know. There's some difficulties there as well.
I love to add a bit of juice.
Okay? A bit of mayo.
A bit of juice. Yeah. All right. Bit of mayo is who I am. Bit of mayo, Carvalis, has another thing to add to this agenda of deal-making conversations we're having,
yes.
And that is, stay with us. We're going to make it sexy, my friends, the news bargaining incentive.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. If you're not in a coma, I'll help you. It's very
technical.
This is about technical.
Journalism, PK.
Oh, it's great for me and for you, but I think normal people are like, what? Mm. It's this deal that's been constructed to basically compensate news organisations for our work being pillaged by the social media companies. They either do deals with us or they pay a penalty, right?
Yep. And so there's been, without getting too much into the weeds of the detail here, some back and forth with the media companies about how much the social media giant should pay and then how many deals with different media companies they should be allowed to do or required to do and how much of a percentage of each of their spend goes to one particular big media company. Unsurprisingly, the big media companies, Nine, News, were pretty keen to have maximum percentage going their way under these deals. So look, that detail's all been negotiated over recent weeks. Again, finally, it looks like this is settled. And look, it's something the Greens, Coalition and Labor all support, in principle. The opposition to this is obviously going to be from the social media giants and potentially from the Trump administration as well. I think that one, let's see whether there's blowback from the US. But of the various deals we're talking about this week, in terms of parliamentary support, this one probably the easiest because, supporting journalism and hitting the social media giants is something that I think there's broad agreement on.
Yeah, I think that's right. Okay, I've been waiting to talk about the next one because it's smoking, and that's...
Sorry. I like what you did there.
I know, I'm such a dag. Far out, man. Tobacco.
Yep.
Tobacco tax has been a huge topic, full stop.
Mm.
Even on the streets of Australia, let me tell you, this is one of those things
particularly where you are.
I'm in Melbourne, ground zero of the tobacco wars.
Mm.
Don't walk past a shop. You might laugh and think I'm being paranoid, but I was walking past one the other day and I said to my girls, let's cross the road.
Wow, really?
Just
didn't want to get too close to it.
I was like, that's all we need.
Can't be too careful.
I'm serious.
Can't be too careful.
So what's this about? Come on, help me.
So it's fascinating in a policy sense, not to mention the drama of the tobacco wars and the bikie gangs and the black market and what all this has generated. But in a policy sense, when do you tax something too much? Sure, everyone wants to bring down smoking rates, but the increase in tobacco excise, what's it gone up? Something like 300% since the turn of the century. I think that's right, in the last 25 years or so. It's a big increase. And then suddenly you've got all these illegal tobacco cigarettes coming in and being sold and everyone's buying them. And so what do? Do you reduce the excise back down to where the illegal product's being sold at? Or is that conceding defeat? Well, yes, it is conceding defeat. But does it actually achieve a reduction in smoking rates? Obviously, is it going to help or hurt excise revenue? Is it going to stamp out the black market? So One Nation are now saying they would cut the excise by 75% to bring a pack of cigs down from $46 to about $21. I don't know, what are the illegal packets being sold for? Probably a little bit less than that at the moment. So they're saying bring it much closer to where the illegal stuff
is. So the gap isn't
exactly. And then freeze the indexation for 3 years. That's One Nation's idea. Look, economist Chris Richardson, who we both know well, plenty of listeners would know well, he thinks this is a pretty sensible move. Yeah, he's someone who looks at the budget bottom line very closely, and he's saying that's actually what we need to do, or something like that. The Coalition haven't criticised it. They're hinting they will have a similar policy soon.
Well, they've got a special body. They've set up a kind of review into it.
A Senate inquiry, and it's due next week.
Yeah. So they've been looking at it for some time, actually.
Whether they go with a 75% cut or a 50% cut, or look, I don't know. Or do they try and outdo the One Nation and say, let's cut it even further, 80%? Anyway, let's see.
You've got Chris Minns in New South Wales.
Well, exactly.
Who's a Labor Premier. arguing it. It's a tricky one, though. So, okay, at a federal level, the government sort of says don't get tricked by the tobacco lobby. And, of course, that's a fair commentary, I think. The tobacco lobby would like a cut to the excise. Okay.
I mean, Mark Butler's saying, here was his quote this morning, "No one's really said to me or to the government where the price point is that actually starts to move the black market guys out of the market." That's a fair point. We don't know whether selling a packet for $20 is going to end the black market. Do they just lower their price down to, I don't know, $10 or less?
That's a very good and, I think, powerful point by Mark Butler.
Yeah.
I don't think that you kind of can reverse the steep increases because of the tax, and then all of a sudden you go back to
what it was. I mean, the black market, these gangs have now set up a supply line. They've set up the retail shop fronts, if you like. They've got the whole market in place. Is that simply going to disappear if you lower the excise back down to something like that? Look, there is one interesting perspective on this. Rowan Pike is someone, I'll plug it here, I'm going to talk to on the Insiders on Background podcast later in the week. He's a former AFP and former Border Force officer. He set up the Border Force's tobacco strike team. He's been arguing we've got to get that excise back down, that enforcement can't fix this job alone, as the government argues. And he points to an experience in Canada in the 90s. The Canadian province of Quebec increased excise. It was overwhelmed with illegal product coming across the US border. The excise rate was, I think, four times higher in Quebec than it was across the border in the US. They had this explosion in organised crime, murders, arson attacks, grenade attacks, you name it. Sounds very similar, doesn't it? Eventually, the Canadian federal government and the Quebec provincial government lowered their excise by about 65%. And apparently, the illegal trade pretty much eliminated very quickly. They then put in place strong enforcement. They still had smoking rates coming down. They had excise revenue increasing because people were buying the legal product once again. So, look, I'm not saying that necessarily will happen here, but it's an interesting parallel or example from the 90s to look at where something pretty similar seems to have happened.
They clearly need to do something pretty dramatic on the policing front.
Yeah.
And that's about resourcing, and I'm no expert in policing. I mean, I wouldn't rely on me for policing. But I do think that we've got like a pretty fundamental and deep-rooted issue. And, you know, that we're making gags. Well, I was trying to at the start. But there is a genuine community safety issue going on. People do feel anxious about this. And that is no place you want to be as state governments and, of course, at the federal level, allowing kind of a system where this proliferates. So,
And you were asking a very good question just before we started recording, PK, which is...
A dumb question, but a good question.
They're always good questions. You know, how is it that so many retail outlets are able to sell something illegal?
Mm. You'd think that the cops would just walk past and go, just going to shut that down. I've got the ability to do it, right? So why not... What else are they selling that they're able to maintain? You know, like what is it about? Is it just that it's too whack-a-mole? There are too many of them? Because I walk past them and I think that is so obviously illegal. I walked past one literally last night. My daughter was soccer training and I was walking past the, you know, and I was like, that? What's that? That's obviously against the law. You know how I love the law.
You should go in and give him a piece of your mind, Peter.
Well, I would if I wasn't scared.
But look, these are really good questions that I'll put to Rowan Pike because he's a former federal police officer and Border Force expert on this. So why can't enforcement do the job, I guess, is the question. How is it able to flourish in the way that it has? But as you would know, in Melbourne, it's just created so many problems, the explosion of this black market. New South Wales as well, and that's why Chris Minns is willing to, you know, call it out as well and say the federal government need to do something about the excise. So, yeah, it's interesting. One Nation, the Coalition, will Labor be able to hold its ground on this, refuse to budge on the rate of excise and simply say the states need to do a better job of policing, or will the pressure get too great for them?
Very interesting question. No answer yet, but there is clearly a lot of pressure. Let's just end, if we can, on an interview with Andrew Hastie. A bit instructive, I think, in many ways. He's trying to make it clear that One Nation policy is reactive, chaotic, can't be relied upon. And that point you made at the beginning of the pod, which beautifully segues to this, that the coalition is considered and detailed and that you can get the kind of right-wing stuff, this is my take of what he's saying, but cost it and it'll work, not just sort of flounced around and made up on the spot. That's what he's trying to say. I, however, have a question for you. Does that land in a disrupted period of time? Are people desperately looking for costed, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think the moment we're in is different.
It's a very good point. Look, a couple of things. Andrew Hastie, this is another example of Andrew Hastie's ability to cut through. He just seems to deliver a line that you think, oh, yeah, good point. So this interview this morning on RN with Sally Sara, he was talking about the tobacco thing and One Nation's idea of slashing excise by 75%. He said, it's not a thought bubble race on X with Pauline Hanson. We want to make sure our policies are costed and modelled and are responsible. It's very easy to get a sugar hit in the headlines. We're doing the hard work. Sally then very cleverly put to him Andrew Bragg's various ideas at the press club just last week and whether they were thought bubbles or costed modelled policies. And Andrew Hastie suddenly was backpedalling into, I don't really remember, it's weeks, a long time in politics. So look, yes, the coalition aren't exactly pure when it comes to always putting out costed, modelled, responsible policies. Sometimes they have thought bubbles themselves. But look, if you're Andrew Hastie or if you're the coalition, yeah, you've got to look more sensible. I think attacking One Nation for thought bubbles on X isn't a bad strategy. I mean, you're right. They can still work for One Nation, and clearly they have traction. But I assume as we get closer to an election, people do want some sense that what people are saying can be delivered or have been thought through, aren't just sort of angry tirades.
Yeah, and what Hastie's pitching at is actually what's working for Albanese. And Albanese's entire political strategy has been, yeah, you might not love everything, but we're the adults in the room. And so the coalition's like, well, Hastie's at least pitching of, let's be a version. That's the version bit. So it's not, they don't want to be like Labor. Let's be a version of the adults in the room so you can feel comfortable parking yourself with our version of adults in the room rather than, you know, these guys who are wild and make up things on the spot. That's the framing. I'm not suggesting they do, but that's the framing. I, however, am not convinced right now in the political cycle that's going to be the winning strategy. I see
maybe
the disruption.
Right.
I'm not
maybe
sure.
You're right.
I think you're right as an election gets closer, but right now people like Andrew Bragg throwing out, you know, all sorts of ideas, flooding the zone. I don't think it's such a bad strategy.
Nor do I think the coalition is necessarily producing costed and modelled policies in the way Andrew Hastie talks about. Let me put a couple to you. We know Angus Taylor, who became leader 6 months ago, made a priority of lowering immigration, but we still don't know. We don't have a costed or modelled policy on that, I think. We get various numbers thrown around last week, but how are they going to get there? What's that going to cost the economy? We don't know. Indexing tax brackets to get rid of bracket creep. Well, that was announced in the budget reply, but what exactly is that going to cost? Has that been modelled? I think it's great to call for costed, modelled, responsible policies, but let's see them. I'm not sure if you can leave it until right on the eve of the election.
Quick note on Lycra. There's a lot of Lycra around Parliament House, David. I mean, were you in it as well?
No, I wasn't.
Come on, mind a bit of Lycra.
I like to ride the bike, get the Lycra on, but I would never stroll through the courtyard in front of the cameras. Angus Taylor, look, I can say it. He pulls it off all right, doesn't he? You know, looks a lot better than I do in Lycra, put it that way.
Oh, David, don't say that about yourself. But I think that, you know, he likes a bike ride and he's doing the poly pedal thing and that's the whole vibe, but yeah.
Yeah, it's poly pedal. Look, it is for a good cause. Tony Abbott was right into this as well every year. I remember because he was PM when he was doing it and we'd have to, you know, media outlets would have to send people to follow them around the country on poly pedal. I'm not sure.
I've been there. I've been on.
There you go. Yeah. You've been on poly pedal.
I have.
It's raising money for veterans largely. So, yes, very good cause. And
I've followed around Abbott in his Lycra for weeks. I have.
There you go.
career highlights.
Tony Abbott, Angus Taylor. Yes, but Angus, I think, has been doing it for many years, including when.
John Anderson was in it in his Lycra that year. Yeah. Deputy Prime Minister. Okay. That's it for Politics Now today. Fran and I tomorrow to wrap up everything in the party room. If you've got a question for us, send a short voice note to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. And David, you'll be back on Saturday for Insiders on Background.
Yep, as mentioned, Rowan Pike, he's the former head of the Border Force's tobacco strike team. So we're having a good look at this vexed issue of tobacco excise.
Excellent. See you, David.
See you, PK.